This is Mae Brussel, and this is the second half of World Watchers, program number 801. When I refer to William Casey as being dead, ever since he had those nervous twitches inside the CIA building about 24 hours before he was to testify regarding the Iran-Contra affair, he was taken to a hospital, brain surgery was done, and nobody has seen a picture of him or a picture at the bedside of William Casey since. He's being fed through some place in his head, and for all purposes, he's just about as dead as Mr. Santos Trafficante, or Edward Lansdale, or Mike Burke, or Clint Murchison. He's in that category, and it's just a matter of hours or days or weeks, but he hasn't functioned since that time when they took him away in the ambulance. Regarding the Clint Murchison Jr., the article describing his death, the obituary in the New York Times, they described him as the scion of one of Texas's famed wildcat oil families who created the Dallas Cowboys. He had been sick with a neurological disorder. His fortune at one time was $250 million. He's been under bankruptcy proceedings. His home was for sale, and he created a team which, as I say, he sold to Brum Bright, a member of the John Birch Society, a close friend of Murchison's. He sold it for $60 million, a Dallas Cowboy. So he was a Phi Beta Kappa from Duke University, was in the Marines. He studied math, got a master's degree at MIT, and he also was a very conservative wheeler and dealer. Penn Jones Jr. wrote in his book, one of the four books, Forgive My Grief, that the evening before John Kennedy was murdered, there was a meeting at the home of Clint Murchison where the decision was made, the final decision, that to go ahead and kill John Kennedy the next morning. Richard Nixon was in town at that home. J. Edgar Hoover was there. And Murchison was a close friend of J. Edgar Hoover. And he had four very important links to what the things that are affecting America today. He provided funds for George Lincoln Rockwell, a head leader of the American Nazi Party, which was later turned over to William Pierce, a former contractor to the Air Force and professor from Oregon, who runs the Nazi Party now. Lee Harvey Oswald had the telephone number of George Lincoln Rockwell in his address book, and Murchison was a huge funder of Rockwell. He also helped Robert Depew of the Minutemen. He helped fund the Minutemen, and they've been involved in various documents, government documents, archives, regarding the murder of John Kennedy. He also was close to Carl McIntyre. This Carl McIntyre was the head of the National Council of Christian Churches, and McIntyre's close contacts were with Albert Osborne, who used the alias Bowen. That's the gentleman who sat on the bus that went to Mexico, to Ahuaco, Mexico, where J. Edgar Hoover ran the team of assassins. This is all described in the Torba document. And Don Norton, one of Albert Osborne's associates and Oswald Double, was affiliated with Carl McIntyre. And J. Edgar Hoover used to spend his summers in California at the horse races close to Clint Murchison. He was very strongly linked to him in not only things they had in common, such as horse races, but in the political far right that constituted assassinations and murders and the coup in Dallas. Now, part of the Christian Defense League was run by Robert Brown and Reverend Gale. Gale was recently arrested. He's one of those names I've been mentioning. Robert Brown was put into business after being a Marines in Southeast Asia and Vietnam by John Singlaub of the Iran-Contra affair. And Robert Brown works with Michael Ledeen of the Defense Department of the National Security Agency. Ledeen affected coups in Europe and works with extreme right wing and was part of the disinformation group around the assassination attempt of John Paul II. And he also was at Grenada with the Grenada Papers with Robert Brown. And this milieu of Charles Willoughby and General Walker and Billy Hargis was close to Clint Murchison. Billy Hargis worked with Frank Sturgis, otherwise known as Frank Fiorini. His name is in the Christic Institute affidavit. If you look up in the index on page 32 or 33, and persons involved the Bay of Pigs operations that were, in fact, in Dealey Plaza and were instrumental in having a part of killing John Kennedy were part of the Clint Murchison group. Murchison was close to H.L. Hunt and Robert Morris, a very kingpin in the Reed Irvine Accuracy and Media Association, And Morris was part of Young Americans for Freedom with Charles Willoughby and Ronald Reagan. Clint Murchison was a key part of these operations that were a national, international combine for assassinations. And John Kennedy was just one of many who were killed, many before and many after. And I got to understand them all the more I studied Kennedy's assassination. Working with Clint Murchison, this group was Edgar Eugene Bradley, who also worked with Clay Shaw in New Orleans, and Ronald Reagan refused to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley when Jim Garrison wanted him for his trial. And Bradley and Carl McIntyre and Albert Osborne, J. Edgar Hoover, all were part of Division 5 of the FBI. So Clint Murchison had a lot of contacts with the people organized around the murder of John Kennedy and worked with them. As I say, this Carl McIntyre, and he also, through Edgar Bradley, worked with Dennis Mower, M-O-W-E-R, a leader of the Southern California Minutemen, and Murchison helped arm the Minutemen. And Bradley said that they wanted him to kill John Kennedy, rather, in 1960, before he was elected. And Edgar Eugene Bradley stayed with a Mr. and Mrs. Adelot in Louisiana, and her husband was a Minuteman. He was a member of the American Nazi Party. And Edgar Eugene Bradley and Mower had discussed the plans to kill John Kennedy, and Murchison put up the money for the Minutemen and the Division 5. He was closely associated with Osborne and this whole milieu. Now, Mauer's close friend was a man named Philip Earl Schreibe, S-C-H-E-I-B, Schreibe, not Schreibe. He stockpiled weapons and arsenals in the California Minutemen, and he was Carl McIntyre's representative who worked with J. Edgar Hoover, Edgar Eugene Bradley, and Mr. Mower, and they were linked and suspected of having a role in killing John Kennedy. And Shive's associate, his name was Keith Gilbert, it still is, and at one time he was in San Quentin for planning to bomb and kill Martin Luther King in California. And Keith Gilbert's co-worker and friend is Richard Butler, who worked on the U2 program at Lockheed, along with Thane Caesar, who killed Robert Kennedy in 1968. Clint Murchison was a part of the Albert Osborne, Reverend Gale, Clay Shaw, Edgar Eugene Bradley, Minutemen milieu. So it would be very reasonable to believe that the conversations heard in his home the night before Kennedy was killed were with the go-ahead, and history has linked these very people to the street assassins. And Murchison was one of the uppers, like J. Edgar Hoover, William Casey, and Edward Lansdale, and Santos Trafficante. And these people were very, very important from the corporate level, from the graduates, from the very fancy schools, the degrees at MIT and so forth, giving the orders on down. And then the Minutemen and the Nazis, American Nazis and German Nazis, then teamed together through the intelligence community and through people like J. Edgar Hoover. Now, to continue accuracy in media for the remaining of the program, I want to update those of you who might not have heard last week or the week before. Actually, this is part four of Accuracy in Media. The chairman of that organization, and he also has Accuracy in Academia, is Reed Irvine, chairman of the board. And the reason I'm doing these broadcasts is that he wrote to President Dr. Tom Clement of Foothill College in Los Altos Hills, and he complained and sent him some transcripts and tapes of programs that Niptuck and David Emery were doing on KFJC, suggesting, as he said, that the government or people, conspiracies were involved in the murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, or that cancer could be caused by our various institutions and organizations. And I took the board of directors and officers off of the stationery of Accuracy in Media and looked them up in Who's Who and also in other material I had on AIM. And last week I shared with you some of the facts about the organization. And I believe that Accuracy in Media goes back much earlier than first described. It allegedly was set up, the corporate papers in 1969 were about to be set up. Nation Magazine had an article somebody, a good friend, sent to me from World Watchers. It came out September 13, 1986, titled The Rise and Decline of Accuracy in Media by Michael Massing and Alan Wolfe. Now, I don't know Massing and I don't know Wolfe, but this alone is disinformation put in a leftist organization. I call it leftist because The Nation is a little different than National Review, if you want a left or a right. And these people have put an article, a long article, saying that Accuracy in Media is on the decline. And there's no reason to believe that AIM isn't as strong today or stronger than when it was formed. And I can analyze this whitewash with you at another time. One interesting part of the article is that it describes Reed Irvine and his son Donald, who's executive secretary of AIM, and board members. And it said the group got its start in 1951 as the Council Against Communist Aggression to provide information to congressional staff members, published the Washington Inquirer, a zealous right-wing weekly, sent out mass mailings, and so forth. Now, 1951 is getting a little bit closer to the truth, and as I cited last week, I broke down, again, that British-American-Canadian corporation that became the World Commerce Corporation, and this was the umbrella network for these various activities and corporate levels that would include later knocking college professors out of the campus and college radios. It would have information contrary to the official line in this country that researchers would have access to. So while Accuracy in Media on the cover was set up in 1969, and particularly by Abraham Kalish, he worked U.S. Information Agency, which is CIA, from 1949 to 1958. And from 1958, he was with the United States Army's Defense Intelligence School. Then he with Reed Irvine and Dean Acheson, and I did a little bit on Acheson last week, were putting this organization together. And I think that the Radio Free America and the U.S. Information Agency, which is practically the same thing, their sister groups, should at this time be examined more carefully, because even the secrecy for those organizations, when you talk of Accuracy in Media, came out in the paper just this week. The San Francisco Chronicle had an article, April the 10th, editors warned of threats to press freedom. And the article says, on the 200th anniversary of our Constitution, we should celebrate our freedom. And Michael Gartner, the head of an organization of newspaper editors, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, cited 17 laws barring the publication or broadcast of information in the United States and warned of other restrictions being considered. He said in 1948, and that's just 3 years after the World Commerce Corporation was set up, by 1948, the Smith-Mund Act forbid the rebroadcast or reprinting of Voice of America editorials in this country. Now, there's been that kind of censorship. We don't know what our agencies, we pay the taxes for the Radio Free America or the U.S. Information Agency, and I didn't realize that they cannot have information shared with us. What they tell other people overseas is not told in America, so we don't know how badly our agencies are lying. Now, last week I broke down just a few second biography, if you can do justice in that time, to board members of AIM, and I went over Dean Acheson, Carl Robert Benditson, Midge Dechter, Shelby Cullum Davis, Ellen Garwood, Dr. Thomas Jukes, Abraham Kalish, Claire Luce, Henry Salvatore, William Simon, Henry Gurney Sagerman, Eugene Wigner, and Lewis William Walt. So there are other names on the board of directors that I want to share with you and go into that information. Now, Covert Action has a long article on Accuracy in Media. It came out several years ago, and I took a lot of my material from their issue, but I also looked up, as I say, in Who's Who and in other books and articles, material that was important for me. And Covert Action is a group that are in Washington, D.C. They will not touch anything about the Kennedy assassination. They don't very often talk about domestic affairs, although they did a thing on AIM. Philip Agee, the well-known former CIA agent, is closely affiliated with their operation. They won't touch Jonestown, but the interesting thing is that they will not touch Henry Kissinger, Fritz Kramer, or the Kennedy assassination. And I hardly know the people back there. I know their names or I spoke to them. They won't touch the Torbett document. That's Kennedy assassination. And I'm wondering why, or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King, the American murders. I wonder why they won't touch those subjects. Now, they go at length about a few people, and they give biographies of some of the better-known board members of AIM. But interestingly enough, they listed in this issue that they printed, the people affiliated with AIM, the original founders or board members. And the name that stuck in my mind was a name that they gave one sentence to, and this man could affect or has affected our history as much as any single person, and he's almost an unknown that slipped through their list without being defined. And this is very important to ask why these people are just passed over. The name is Dr. William Yandel Elliott. They describe him as, this is how they describe him, as part of the AIM operation, original board or former board member. Dr. William Yandel Elliott, one-time Harvard University government professor who was on the National Security Council's planning board and was a trustee of Radio Liberty, long sponsored by the CIA. He was on the National Security Council's planning board. We had no National Security Council when World War II was over in 1945. By 1947, we had a national security, and this was the back door of the White House, the planning stage that became operational. As soon as Richard Nixon was elected and Henry Kissinger could open those doors and do secret operations without Congress knowing, ignoring Congress. Now, Dr. William Yandel Elliott is the mentor of Henry Kissinger and of Alexander Haig's family and Kissinger family at Harvard, and I looked up his name just in two books on Henry Kissinger. He's in almost every book on Henry Kissinger. There's one called "The Kissinger, the Uses of Power" by David Landau, and it describes Henry Kissinger in this way and his relationship to this Yandel Elliott, who's affiliated with Accuracy and Media. It said, "The most dangerous flaw of Henry Kissinger is believing that domestic opinion should never be an obstacle to the conduct of foreign policy. If you feel that the internal relation should be conducted on non-ideological grounds, he then assumes that the internal policy should not extend to foreign ventures, that he should be able, whoever's in charge, should be able to do whatever they want to do." And keep in mind that Kissinger and Haig are proteges of Fritz Kramer and this character from Harvard, who was more than a Harvard professor, as you see, this William Yandel Elliott, helped form the National Security Council and was from Radio Free Liberty, which is CIA. The book on the uses of power by David Landau talks about Henry Kissinger's ideas about global influence and his anti-Soviet policy and how the United States allies should all get together with regimes not on the basis of domestic structure, but on the basis of their hostility towards the Soviet Union. In many areas of the Third World, there would be no viable alternative between regimes headed by right-wing strongmen on the one hand and a popular front government. We must support the military power, and it reduces itself to military power alone. Even in Europe, the cradle of civilization, Washington bolstered a number of right-wing regimes to maintain NATO unity. In Greece, we put in the military junta, the former Nazis, in Portugal and in Spain, with Franco, of course. And the underlying rationale of bolstering right-wing regimes is that the decision-makers believe that American domestic opinion isn't of consequence, that Washington's behavior abroad should serve not day-to-day needs of the popular sovereignty, but a grander vision of nation-state diplomacy. Well, at Harvard, when Henry Kissinger was at Harvard, upon his arrival in 1946, the day after, the year after the war was over, he went right into the laps of the Harvard policy intellectuals, and his fame and fortune began when he was tied to William Yandel Elliott, a small-town boy from Tennessee, turned brilliant scholar, all-American tackle at Vanderbilt, who became the ruling power in Harvard's Department of Government. He studied at Oxford, as did Reed Irvine, then came back to the United States and prepared young disciples and senior scholars in his way of thinking. Even by the standards of the late 40s, he was a violent cold warrior, one who would not tolerate the slightest deviation from the path of unrelenting struggle against the Stalinist terror. And that was Elliot. They described him in the late 40s as something as a King Lear figure stalking a rainy, windy moor. This is Kissinger, the uses of power. Wild Bill Elliot had gone to war with the rest in the country in the 40s. He got prominence in the office of war mobilization. He was intoxicated with power and the lust of power and the purpose of power. He transmitted to Henry Kissinger. Well, it was John J. McCloy, the attorney for the Rockefeller interest for Chase Manhattan for I.G. Farben, along with Fritz Kramer from Germany, who was then in the Defense Department or getting out of the Dachau prison to go into the Defense Department, that put Kissinger in the laps of Mr. Elliott. They had a chain of command, and Kissinger Associates becomes the roving State Department, or as Representative Henry Gonzalez said, the hired gun. The State Department rented out to Kissinger Associates. Elliott made use of Kissinger's talents as a scholar's assistant. With Elliott, Kissinger founded and directed the International Seminar, under which several dozen bright and influential foreigners spent the summer months at Harvard. And thanks to Elliott, Kissinger founded and edited a scholarly journal called Confluence, and he managed a magazine called Foreign Affairs. Then Kissinger went on to the Council of Foreign Relations, where he became the chief expert on the subject of nuclear weapons. Under the tutelage of Elliott, he worked with McGeorge Bundy, who was National Security Advisor under the late John Kennedy, who was murdered, and he was a close friend of Henry Kissinger's. And Elliott was a big influence, and he turns out to be one of the founders of the National Security Council and also an active participant with Reed Irvine in Accuracy in Media. Another book which would not be favorable to Henry Kissinger, she was trying to criticize him, but of course, whether you like him or dislike him, the story always comes out the same. Phyllis Schlafly and an Admiral Chester Ward wrote a book called Kissinger on the Couch. And she describes in this book Kissinger's relationship with the elitist groups to understand his motivation, how he got on the Council of Foreign Relations, and how Kissinger wrote an early book in 1961 called The Necessity for Choice. Now, Robert Mayhew of the FBI and CIA had already linked up with Santos Trafficanda to setting up death squads as of the summer of 1960, and Henry Kissinger becomes an expert in his book, The Necessity for Choice. You don't have much choice when a bullet blows your brain off. And John Kennedy said there was this hidden government behind his back and fingered Alan Dulles. And, of course, Kissinger and Elliott and these people worked closely with Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy and, of course, William Donovan of the OSS. The Schlafly book says that more than any other man living today, Kissinger is a creation of the Council of Foreign Relations. He owes his associations in the ruling clique to two people. First, after high school, when he went in the U.S. Army as a private, and by 1943, he had met with his benefactor who changed his life, private, later Colonel Fritz Kramer, who in 1943 was lecturing to Army audiences on the U.S. objectives in the war against the Nazis. Private Kramer was a German from a distinguished family whose wife and son Sven were living in Nazi Germany during the war, as I said before many times. And he worked closely with Henry Kissinger, picked him up, and Kissinger acquired an interest in philosophy, political theory, international relations, and as the war progressed, Dr. Fritz Kramer attained promotions for his abilities, and in turn, he brought his protege to the attention of the superiors, and Kissinger became translator for the commanding general and later administrator of an occupied German district. This was in Oberammergau with the likes of Klaus Barbie. So Phyllis Schlafly and the Navy officer are saying this was one of his mentors. Kramer became a civilian advisor to the Secretary of the Army on military and political strategy. He is still there when they wrote this book. He survived McNamara's 7-year dictatorship in the Pentagon, which, of course, they worked with. And she's saying that was a mystery how he survived. But out of Harvard and having the same people in common and mentors, Kramer and Kissinger and McNamara proceeded then to Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam to decimate Southeast Asia. She writes his son Sven Kramer survived more than 5 years on Kissinger's staff. Sven had written his honors thesis at Harvard under Kissinger's auspices, and he worked with Elliott. He went to work for the pre-Kissinger National Security Council during the Johnson administration, and he's still there now. It's either Fritz Kramer or Sven Kramer. According to Evans and Novak, they can have it both ways, or it's both, but they're still running the National Security Council. And then the other mentor that they describe in Kissinger's undergraduate work at Harvard, he came up and signed up with a distinguished anti-communist, Dr. William Yandell Elliott. The combination of such a mentor with Kissinger's intellect resulted in graduation summa cum laude in 1950. He got his master's degree in 52, his doctorate in 54. Professor Eliot was the last anti-communist who influenced Henry Kissinger's life or career, except for Dr. Edward Teller. Now, Teller's on the board of Accuracy in Media. Teller's on the board of Western Goals, the father of the hydrogen bomb. Of course, Phyllis Schlafly thinks that these are the last two anti-communists. Henry Kissinger has been nothing but a rabid anti-communist, putting fascists into governments, overthrowing democracies, whether it's Iran or Chile or South Korea or Vietnam or Bolivia or the United States. He's been part of the team with the global strategy. It doesn't matter who's there if it's not a communist. And in this book, she mentions those mentors of his, Eliot and Kramer, who had the big influence on his life. They also write in their book, the Council of Foreign Relations gave him the title of having the most prestige as Director of Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy Studies for the Council of Foreign Relations. And the book that he wrote, Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, in 1957, brought Henry Kissinger fame, fortune, influence, and prestige, and ultimately entree into the White House, where he was National Security Advisor, where he began to run those secret operations that literally took over the government and ignored the Congress, the Defense Department, the CIA. The seeds of Contragate were set up by Fritz Kramer and Mr. Eliot. And the interesting thing is that I didn't know where this professor from Harvard was coming from, but sure enough, he helped form the National Security Council, and then he had the body or the framework to put his agents like Henry Kissinger or Admiral Poindexter or Robert McFarlane and so forth. Now, to a few more people on the board of Accuracy and Media, before the time runs out, I would like to just mention a few of them. One is a man named Murray Barron. He's described as a past and present officer. He was among the past who had served, and he's still very active with Accuracy and Media. He's been with them since 1972. That was just before the Watergate came tumbling down, because as soon as Richard Nixon was in power, by 1969, the government began to change face, and a lot of these people got their real far right-wing muscle, because the COINTEL program and the operations that were planned were to turn this country into a literal fascist state with burglaries, mail openings, and surveillance, and mind control, drug operations on people. The powers that be were going bananas once they finally got the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and Malcolm X tucked away. They could do whatever they want. Murray Barron joined AIM in 1972, and he has been the president since 1976. He first made his living in 1930 in the Teamsters Union in New Jersey in labor and industrial relations. He was a trustee of Freedom House, a right-wing counterpart to Amnesty International, a member of the CIA organization Citizens Committee for a Free Cuba. Now, Citizens Committee for a Free Cuba was operated out of Mullen Associates, that's E. Howard Hunt, and the Watergators in Washington. One of their clients was Riley Coffee Company, where Lee Harvey Oswald was employed. And the president of AIM, Murray Barron, was part of the CIA-sponsored Citizens Committee for Peace and Freedom in Vietnam. And in exchange for many introductions he has made to Accuracy in Media, he introduces right-wing and corporate support. He gets a finder's fee of $1,000 a month. A lot of these biographies I'm getting from the covert action. I haven't even looked them up in Who's Who yet, but you can get a little smack of who they are, and then I can do more on them. Another board member is Elbridge Dubrow, who joined the State Department in 1930, held diplomatic posts in Poland, Romania, Soviet Union, Italy, Portugal, Malaysia, was ambassador to Vietnam from 1957 to 61. Diem was murdered in 63, October of 63. Before retiring in 1968, he left the diplomatic field to serve as an advisor to the commander of Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Richard Secord was down there for a while after West Point. In 1971, he was director of Freedom Studies Center, set up by the far-right American Security Council. He still has a hand in AIM affairs, even though he now is 81 years old. This whole Accuracy in Media is a Defense Department CIA operation set up with the corporate level, and it is a disservice for authors in Nation magazine to say it declined, because for all we know, they may have stopped professors from all over all over this country from holding on to their tenure or their jobs. And how do we know that Accuracy Media wasn't in charge of, say, WBAI or Pacifica Radio? They called Bob up and took Bob Fass and Mae Brussels programs off the air, and there was no way that anything like that could be heard on BAI again. And that in Manhattan, there are a lot of people who hear that station, and also in Berkeley with KPFA or LA KPFK. Pacifica is a foundation, and those foundations can be touched by people writing letters that you don't always see how they write or what they say. But the head of these radio stations makes sure that except for a guest appearance, there is no way you can get back on those programs. Well, I wanted to do about 20 more people involved with AIM, but our time is up. I see that. I can't continue. So I'll have to do part 5 maybe next week. It's very, very important. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussels. I'll be back with you next week. Thank you for keeping track with the books, records, and keep reading the papers and following this very interesting news.